Good day to you, sir.
And a very good day to you.
Today in Studio 360, the director Mike Lee made his reputation with edgy, super realistic movies about the way we live now. But turns out nobody makes a better movie about celebrated historical figures either.
You're too preoccupied for your own good, sir.
Nothing comes from nothing, madam.
And we have had nothing from you, sir.
You can research for a million years. You can read every word that's ever been written about a thing. But that doesn't make it happen in front of the camera.
Mike Lee and his new film, Mr. Turner. And later in the hour, the very young star composer Matthew O'Coin puts us into a thunderstorm.
For me, music, including classical music, is cathartic and overwhelming, and I want people to feel it that way.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and more is ahead in Studio 360. But to start the show,
New Year's resolutions.
For the last couple of years, we've asked you to declare New Year's resolutions, not losing weight or starting to meditate, but to take on some creative project. Last January, we heard from Mike Doty. You probably know him as the leader of the band Soul Coughing.
I don't need to walk around in circles.
He resolved that in 2014, he would compose a rock opera he's been thinking about for a long time based on the Book of Revelation.
The Spirit took control of me. I heard a loud voice.
He made good on that resolution, and later this month, we will present the world premiere of Mike Doty's Revelation at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space in New York City. Information and tickets are at studio360.org.
Write the things you have seen and what is and what will be. Write the things you have seen and what is and what will be.
When North Korea probably sabotaged Sony Pictures last month and threatened terrorism in America because of a satirical movie, it was scary, but it also seemed like a kind of weird comedy itself. This week, a terror group outraged by satire lashed out in the most horrifying, appalling, tragic way possible. In Paris, Islamist gunmen stormed the offices of the French newspaper Charlie Hebdo, murdering staff members and the police officers assigned to protect them. To try to understand the attack on Charlie Hebdo, I called Adam Gopnik. Adam was Paris correspondent for The New Yorker for many years and is the author of the bestseller Paris to the Moon. Adam, thanks for talking with me today.
Good to talk to you, Kurt.
So Charlie Hebdo, am I pronouncing that more or less correctly?
More or less, yes.
It's described as a satirical weekly, but it is not The Onion. It is not like anything we have in this country. What's in there and in a typical week? What does it do?
In certain ways, Kurt, it's a much more old-fashioned kind of satirical weekly, more the kind of thing you'd associate with the 19th century, sort of scabrous cartoons about a passing event, not at all meta or ironic in the way that an American equivalent might be, but old-fashioned vitriolic mockery. And I think the thing to emphasize is that it is a true equal opportunity offender. I'm just looking at some old covers as we speak, and there's obscene mockery of the virgin birth of Jesus. There's constant mockery of rabbis. So we're talking here about a magazine whose motto truly was nothing is sacred. This was not an anti-Islamic magazine in any sense, a true equal opportunity, old-fashioned, Daumier, Rabelais kind of enterprise.
In a country that, from the revolution on, has had anti-clericalism, anti-religion as part of its mission statement, does it play a big role in sort of French literary media political culture?
It's not at the center of daily debate the way that, you know, the great newspapers are.
Right.
But yes, it's played an increasingly large role in the last few years. This A horrific massacre today is in a certain sense the climax, if I can use that word, of a series of legal attacks that were made on Charlie Hebdo over the last few years by various Islamic groups for having published cartoons that were contemptuous or mocking of Muhammad and of Islam. And they were properly and consistently acquitted on the grounds that there's no law in France against blasphemy or isn't any longer. So they think that in the era of the Internet, an old-fashioned caricature magazine wouldn't have that much grip, but exactly the intensity of their enemies gave them more and more presence until this horror.
And France has a larger Muslim population, 7 or 8%, I read, than any other EU country.
This does certainly come at a moment of maximum pressure on the question of Islam in France. You may have heard about Eric Zemmour's book, which has been a huge bestseller in France, kind of a right-wing polemic against Islam. Michel Houellebecq, the very controversial, I hate to use that word.
Provocative, deliberately provocative novelist.
Deliberately provocative French novelist has a new book out that's a kind of satirical fantasy about a near future in which all of France has become Islamized.
And Houellebecq is the cover subject of the current issue.
Of the last issue, of the latest issue, let us hope, of Charlie Hebdo is about Houellebecq, where he's shown as Nostradamus, making his prophecies. And of course, the satirists of Charlie Hebdo are mocking his pretensions to be a mordant prophet of the hideous Islamic future. So they were mocking the very man who you would think they would find sympathetic on
right.
this.
And do you imagine that the Islamist terrorists who did this are really bothered by the caricatures and so forth that have appeared in Charlie Hebdo? Or is it an attack on free speech, which is so important in a country like France and in the West generally? And they know that that's our sore spot that will maximize outrage on our part.
You know, I can't read the minds of these lunatics, right? But I think that it's possible that they burn with the sense that their religion is being eclipsed and humiliated and shamed all the time. I suspect that it inflames them, infuriates them to see the thing that they hold on to being treated in a mocking way. So I would suspect that it is the very act of iconoclasm that enrages them so much.
And what do you foresee the effect of this being in France? Will Charlie Hebdo and its kind and commentary continue as before, or will it change?
France is a sophisticated and liberal country, and I don't think people will confound the Islamists with the great majority of ordinary Muslim people in France. I do think that the risk, if there is one, is that it tends to justify or legitimize the far-right account of what's happening in France, you know, that Islam presents an immediate threat to the continuing existence of France. When you have an act like this, it serves those folks. So I think the threat comes, as always with terrorism, comes less from the immediate threat it makes on people than from the autoimmune response, the excessive autoimmune response
right.
that we can put into place against it. But I don't listen, I don't want to sound mealy-mouthed about this either. Islamic fanaticism and the terrorism it evokes is a real, not an imaginary, not an invented, not a neocon illusion. It's a real thing, and it's frightening, and it's threatening, and it's murderous, and it has to be eliminated.
Adam Gopnik, thank you very much.
Pleasure talking, Kurt.
Adam Gopnik writes for The New Yorker and is the author of Paris to the Moon. The 19th century British painter J.M.W. Turner still inspires awe with his evocative pictures of eternal landscapes and brand spanking new speeding locomotives. For how his nearly abstract late paintings anticipate the Impressionist painters of decades later. In a new movie, Mr. Turner, Timothy Spall plays the painter as a genius, all right, a grunting, grimacing, sour, disheveled genius.
And how do we find you on this fair morning?
Exceedingly preoccupied, madam.
Was ever thus? You've always been preoccupied. You're too preoccupied for your own good, sir.
Nothing comes from nothing, madam.
And we have had nothing from you, sir.
The film's writer and director is Mike Lee, who for four decades has been making movies about very ordinary, contemporary, middle-class Britons muddling through. Secrets and Lies, Another Year, Happy-Go-Lucky. Lee's movies are not violent or noisy or action-packed, and he manages to get astonishingly close to the texture of real life. Over dozens of films, Lee has cultivated a troupe of actors who work with him to develop the scripts of the movies they're going to act in. He walked me through that process.
There are films, and Mr. Turner, I suppose, is one of them because it's based on historical characters to a great extent. Well, we do know who the characters
right.
are, and we do have a general sense of what it is. But normally, the job really is to I mean, I don't have a basic structure or indeed basic characters. I cast actors and then
really?
I explore with each actor and we create a character.
You've got nothing. You've got no...
Well, I have a sort of... It varies from film to film, but I have a kind of sense of the thing or a sense of the spirit or the maybe a theme or
milieu or...
Lots of things. Yeah, but lots of different things floating around. I mean, the journey of making the film is the job of discovering what the film is, really.
But the actors, or certainly the lead actors, help you discover who the characters are and what the story
No, I collaborate with each actor. Every actor agrees to take part and simply only knows whatever his or her character will know, which makes it possible to investigate situations in a completely truthful and organic way.
But then once there's a script, it's a locked-in script. They're not making up lines on the set, are they?
No, they're not making up lines in front of the camera.
I can imagine for a suit, a producer, a studio person, that must sometimes seem like just... the chaos of that and the unpredictability of that, a thing they just want nothing to do with.
Well, that's why they've got nothing to do with it, frankly. I mean, if you're talking about studios, they've got nothing to do with it. Really.
Yeah. So when you're dealing with a movie about historical figures like Gilbert and Sullivan or like J.M.W. Turner, that must transform this improvisational, collective, collaborative creation process.
Yes, I mean, there's an extra dimension to it. I mean, there's a lot of research. But even when we make contemporary films where we're completely inventing the characters and the stories, we still do a massive amount of research into all sorts of things.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You can research for a million years. You can read every word that's ever been written about a thing. You can look at every picture.
Right.
But that doesn't make it happen in front of the camera. So all the work that goes on always with these films of mine, which is about character and relationships and the actual moment-to-moment existence of flesh and blood people, still happens with the added thing of having found out about who they are, so that you can then feed that into the process and, as it were, bring them to life.
Turner, like most of the characters in your films, is not a posh guy. His father's a barber. He's got this thick Cockney accent when he's not just grunting. Lots of other characters in the film clearly look down on him. Were all those things part of his attraction to you as a character?
Yes. I'm not sure how many people look down on him, actually.
The Queen does.
The Queen certainly does. Yeah. Queen Victoria loathed his paintings.
Yeah.
But I think that's less a matter of looking down on him because he's from a working-class background, and more that she just couldn't stand
the
his work.
The work,
she hated it.
Yeah.
No, interestingly, I mean, I think there's a big sequence where he goes into the Royal Academy of Painters, and I think you can see in there a kind of respect they have for him.
Good morning, Mr. Turner. Good morning,
Sir Billy Gussie.
Good day,
Billy. Delighted you could join us.
Damn fine spectacle this year, Billy.
Mm-hmm. Aha! Very fine day to you, Mr. Stoddart!
Mr. Turner, sir!
He's very secure.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very much part of the establishment there. But they all know he's different.
Right.
They know he's better.
Right.
And, you know, he's something of an anarchist.
Yes.
And, of course, what happens in that scene, they used to call it Varnishing Day, and they'd all used to finish off their
So they're all there in the gallery, which looks like a scene made up for the movies, but
they did that. They're all there in the gallery, and they all used to come in and finish their paintings off because they didn't know how they were going to hang in the light or whose paintings they were going to be near. And on that particular occasion in 1832, Turner's painting, which was a rather grey painting, a seascape with a ship with boats, was next to this painting by Constable, who was his sort of arch rival. It was a very bright red painting.
And by the way, a great painter.
And a great painter, not as great a painter in my view. And plainly a painter with no sense of humour, because what Turner does for a joke, and he did it, lots of people saw it, so it's a famous event, he put this red blob on his own painting and then with his fingers turned it into a boy, B-U-O-Y.
And it looks as though he's both vandalising his own painting and making fun of, of Constable.
Yes, you know, he's kind of cool, really.
Yeah.
And Constable can't take it. He walks out, really.
When you found that fact, you must have gone, whoa, this is what this was made for the movies.
Absolutely. Same as him having himself strapped to the mast of a ship to paint a storm.
Which you show. And I thought, oh, this is maybe just some dreamlike magical realist thing, no?
No. Well, there are modern academics who say, no, he didn't. But he said he did.
The movie spans many years, I guess decades, actually.
26 years.
And Turner develops his proto-impressionist style that we think of as his signature now, these almost abstract seascapes, which were insanely ahead of his time in the 1840s.
Yes.
you have other characters speculate about what's he doing, why is he painting this way, but he never says a word. You never have his character saying a word. Why is that?
Because I don't think he did. I don't think he
theorized.
No? I don't think so.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's for us to ponder. Really,
do you have a hunch? I mean, an older man suddenly going radical as he did.
Well, I think the important thing about Turner and what we're talking about is that, I mean, if you look at his earliest work and the work as it progresses, it's really grounded and solid. I mean, he really, really could paint and draw, and he just was so good that he then was able to move on and you know, become more sophisticated still.
Do you see any of yourself in Turner?
Not especially. I mean, people say, oh, it's autobiographical, but it's not. I mean, I have children, and I'm very proud of them. If you mention them to me, I will start talking about them very eloquently and at great length.
Then I won't.
But Turner in the film, as you know, on some occasions actually denies he even has children. You know,
yes.
Can't be bothered.
Which are his most horrific displays of character.
I think that's right. The truth of it is that it's, of course, he's an artist. We who make these things are kinds of artists, and I sympathize, empathize, and understand what that's about, but that doesn't make it autobiographical.
Your film Happy Go Lucky from 2008 starred Sally Hawkins as Poppy, who's a school teacher, decides to take driving lessons from an instructor who turns out to be extremely creepy. I want to play a clip. Here, Poppy is taking her first lesson. Her driving teacher is played by Eddie Marsan.
Nobody's called me Pauline since I was 2 years old. Makes me laugh.
Well, what am I supposed to call you?
Oh, how about Poppy?
Poppy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Nah, whatever turns you on, Scott. I don't mind.
Okay, Poppy. Your boots are inappropriate for a driving lesson.
Why? What's wrong with them?
You can't control a car in high heels.
Oh, no, I could do a lot of things in these. You should see me in these babies on a dance floor.
Well, they may be good on a dance floor.
No, they're not just good on a dance floor. They are, ooh.
They may be good in a pink Cadillac on a beach when you're pissed with your boyfriend, but they're not suitable for driving.
You're funny.
Now, next. That was Sally Hawkins and Eddie Marsan in Happy Go Lucky. You've got a reputation for making a lot of melancholic films, movies that leave a kind of tristesse in the air. But Poppy is somebody clearly determined to find every glass half full. And in your terrific film, Another Year from 2010, you show how some people manage to be happy, even if others fail to do that. Have you become lately more interested in the pursuit of happiness?
No. I think,
okay, good.
No, because all of my films are about all of these things.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is, the reason why the things you're talking about and posing, and I'm not saying, yes, it's this, and let's put it in this box and put that label on it, is because life is complex and subtle and contradictory and all of those things. And movies on the whole don't depict life in that way. Movies on the whole are black and white,
yes,
and are simplistic,
yes,
and are boring.
Yes.
And I try and make films that aren't all of those things.
Mike Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner is in theaters now. Mike Lee and I talked for the better part of an hour, and you can hear that extended version of our conversation at studio360.org. Coming up, we're heading out to the Southern California desert to a place called Cal Earth, where people are living in domed bungalows that look like something out of a sci-fi movie. A particular sci-fi movie set on the planet Tatooine.
Luke, tell Uncle if he gets a translator, be sure it speaks Bocce.
That's ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360.
So how do you two feel about each other this Valentine's Day?
Oh my gosh, I totally love him.
And I'm crazy about her.
We like to offer you projects that encourage you to work your creative muscles. We call them extra credit challenges. And we've got a new one now that I think you'll love, or at least like, or maybe like.
A little bit of love.
We want you to make and send us a romantic comedy. A romantic comedy of 30 seconds or less.
I'm pregnant.
With emotion?
With a baby.
The meet cute, the wedding, the breakup, none or all of the above. Whatever story you can tell in 30 seconds or less. And judging our contest will be the director Kevin Smith, who made Chasing Amy, Zach and Miri Make a Porno, and is currently shooting the second sequel to Clerks. Listeners, you've got until February 1st to send us your 30-second movie. All the details are at studio360.org/romcom.
You complete me. I'll have what she's having.
The writer Gina Fattori has always been a fan of romantic comedies, especially ones by Jane Austen. As a kid, Gina always liked to write, but growing up, she wasn't sure she could turn that avocation into her vocation.
I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't grow up in a world where people were writers, and it was obviously not a practical way to support myself.
So at first, she earned a living as a newspaper copy editor. Then, one day in 1995, she saw the Beverly Hills adaptation of Austen's Emma, Amy Heckerling's film Clueless.
Isn't my house classic? The columns date all the way back to 1972.
So I guess the scenes that I can picture are Cher and Josh sitting on the couch watching TV, and he's sort of upbraiding her, which is what Mr. Knightley does to Emma all the time, about how she needs to be essentially a better person.
Hey!
Hi, you just got here and already you're playing Couch Commando?
Hey, you know, in some parts of the universe, maybe not in contempo casual, but in some parts, it's considered cool to know what's going on in the world.
Thank you, Josh. I so need lessons from you on how to be cool. Tell me that part about Kenny G again.
To me, that really helped me crystallize why the Austen novels had always had such meaning to me, because everything in them is so completely applicable to the present day in a way that I guess I've always seen. And it always amazes me when people go on and on about, oh, there's horses and carriages and corsets, and it has nothing to do with present day. Whereas courtship and hurt feelings and all of these things exist not just in high school, but virtually in every aspect of society. Maybe 4 years later, I was living in L.A. I had managed to get my first job as a TV writer, which was obviously something I really didn't know existed when I was growing up. And I ended up getting this job on this show called Dawson's Creek.
Dawson, what exactly do you know about my life these days? I mean, think about it.
It was a teen show. It was about high school kids, and it was totally about their relationships with each other.
I don't know a thing about your life either.
Dude, I'm sorry if I've been distant, but that, I thought that's what we needed.
I guess, in retrospect, the only way I had to sort of think about stories like that was to think about Jane Austen. I think the Jane Austen novels, my theory in a way is that they're serialized drama about the minutiae of who likes whom. And people always say nothing happens, nothing happens, nothing happens. Things happen, but then what happens is the action stops and people talk about what just happened and you're getting to know the characters. This is basically how we would kind of structure Dawson's Creek episodes, where something would happen in the beginning, some small thing, some misunderstanding, somebody would ask somebody to go to a dance or whatever it was. And in the second act of the story, they would parse, what does this mean? What should I do? They'd sort of lay out what the problem was.
Recently, you and I spoke about unrequited feelings at a certain someone.
Namely Pacey.
Namely Pacey may have had for me.
I wrote the scene of Joey and Jen are walking down a street and they're talking about Joey's dilemma at the time, which is she loves Pacey, but she hasn't told Dawson yet that she loves Pacey. And Jen is basically saying, you should do this, you should tell Dawson.
But the thing is, my feelings have been clouded by my fear of what Dawson will do or say once he knows. When we tell him, Dawson gets hurt.
And I even, in this scene, I am ashamed to admit, I stole, like, almost exactly a line from Jane Austen from a scene in Persuasion.
So, whatever I do, I'm the villain. And the girl's always the villain, right? In stories like these, she's always some wicked, conniving whore who manipulates her way between two brothers or two best friends.
Okay, Joey, keep in mind that most of those stories have been written by men.
It's my most egregious Jane Austen ripoff. Eventually, later on, many years later, I ended up working on Gilmore Girls.
Hey, how's the food coming? I'm starving.
Who is that?
The character of Luke has this classic, very Austen male characteristic, which is that he's very plain spoken.
I don't know, this is new for me.
And Lorelai, who is in many ways one of these sort of clueless Jane Austen heroines, talks incessantly.
Usually when I come in, you say hi, and then I say hi, and you tell me what's going on in your life, and I tell you what's going on in my life. It's not curing the bird flu or anything, but it's been a nice tradition.
And on Gilmore, the only relief you ever got from this was in these scenes with Luke. So part of the journey of the arc of the Gilmore Girls involved Lorelai having some realization about who she loves. And that is the classic Jane Austen clueless heroine who's going to understand the state of her own heart.
Luke, will you?
Yes.
Well, you don't have to answer, so...
Yes.
We can take a minute to...
No.
So, what now?
Basically, I consider myself a spinster. I mean, I've lived my whole life without ever having any of these little relationships, these sort of mock marriages, I guess, that people have. And it's only recently, I guess, that I've realized that that ironic distance voice of Jane Austen, which is really her voice, is what captured me. Certainly not the stories of, oh my God, I'm going to meet someone, fall in love, and get married. Like, I didn't think, wow, Mr. Knightley, he's the real prize. Like, I guess I thought literary immortality, that's the prize. I just wanted to be Jane Austen. That's all I wanted.
Gina Fattori has written for Californication, Parenthood, and other shows. She listens to our show in Los Angeles. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story. Is there some movie or novel or other work of art that's changed your life somehow? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org, and we might put you on the air. When I ask, what will the house of the future look like? What pops into your mind is probably shiny and sleek with screens on every surface, like an Apple store crossed with the Jetsons. The architect Nadir Khalili, who died in 2008, had a very different idea about the house of the future. He developed a method of making dome buildings out of a kind of adobe. They're efficient, resilient, incredibly cheap to build, the ultimate in sustainable housing. So how come you can't buy one? Studio 360's Eric Malinsky got in the car with some friends in Los Angeles and drove out to see Khalili's prototypes for himself at a place called Cal Earth.
Rudy Burden and Nora Murphy live a pretty sweet life. They're artists who work on cartoon shows like The Simpsons. They live in a charming neighborhood of bungalows just off Hollywood Boulevard. But they secretly dream of living in a giant igloo made of dirt.
And here's Keller, you can see on your right.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's totally different.
We drove an hour east of LA to the town of Hesperia. As I entered Cal Earth, I felt like I was walking onto the set of Luke Skywalker's house.
It's like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings put together.
The connection to outer space is not a coincidence. The idea for these homes came from a lunar colony. It started out as a NASA project, designed by the Iranian architect Nadir Khalili, who passed away in March of 2008. When I spoke with him in the fall of 2007, he told me he believed his designs would catch on, here on Earth, if only people would start asking the right questions.
After the disasters, the question is wrong when we ask, when is FEMA coming? What type of insurance do you have? What is the problem? In the rest of the world, they ask always, when is UN coming? The right question is, why are buildings burn? Why are they falling apart in a hurricane? Why are they these? That is the question that will be the basis of a great solution.
The ecodomes, also known as super adobes, don't use any wood. There are no right angles. And they're very affordable. The shell of an 800-square-foot house costs $10,000.
They're just using the earth under our feet. Almost anywhere in the world you can use this earth. And then we put it in these long sandbags. We call it tube, super adobe tubes. And then we lay them, we put them in the layers after we put some earth in it, pack in there, and then add maybe 10% cement, concrete in it. And then on top of that, after we tamp it, we put a layer of barbed wire, four-point barbed wire. Just it will work with the next layer, just like a Velcro. Yeah. Stick every layer to the next layer.
I took a walk through the domes with my friends, Rudy and Nora. The early ones are very simple. They're almost like mosques. Eventually, we made our way to a super adobe ranch house. It's meant to be in the same league as the suburban homes that surround Cal Earth.
In any hallways or anything, they just stacked the arches like a pyramid, and so you just weave in and out of the rooms, which is really nice.
We're underground right now. I mean,
yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's
Cal Earth is probably the only place in Hesperia that doesn't need air conditioning. The cool air from the night gets trapped in the domes,
but it also gives you this amazing view.
This is going to be the strangest view out of a kitchen window I've ever seen.
Yeah. And then there's this beautiful little earth dome house right across the street. The neighbors got it too.
Showing up at Cal Earth is almost like showing up at a casting call for Southern California characters. There's an Indian chief, Charles Wood, of the Chimoabian tribe.
For me, to build a house, that cement truck has to come 80 miles. And here I see a possible answer for my people.
Jim Guerra represents Mexican migrant farm workers.
They work with flowers and strawberries. And like most farm workers today, they live on the ground. There's no housing, no toilets, no showers.
Savannah Sierra Glazer came here from Santa Monica with her fiancé. They're shopping for houses.
I'm not sure what that dome over there is called, the big, big, big one. Mm-hmm. We'd like that to be the center and have like six of the little ecodomes around it, connected to it. So something like that where it would develop community for the people that we invite over. Because we'd like to entertain a lot of people.
River Oliveira just has a thing for domes.
Well, yeah, that's what domes do. They give that kind of energy. The electromagnetic field, it functions in that method. Huh. So when you're in it, you're part of it.
That's very beautiful.
Thanks. Life's beautiful.
Yeah.
Breathing's beautiful.
But the super adobes are more than funky. They're sturdy. Phil Vittori is a structural engineer.
Now, I started when I was 20, I think I was 24 years old, and I'm 70 now, so that's a lot of years in the dome business.
He collaborated with Kalili for 10 years, and they shared an appreciation for the simple physics of a curve.
If you take a stick and put it between two points and you put a weight in the center, you'll see the stick deflects downward. If you take that same stick and you curve it into an arch, when you put weight on it, it does not bend downward. Now, if you take an arch and you rotate the arch through 360 degrees, you end up with a dome.
Children who come here and we tell them to bring a boiled egg, and we tell them to try to break it by putting it between the palm of their hands. And of course, the more they push, the more double, triple of them press, I can't. And they're, of course, very, very surprised always because an egg is nothing, you see. But that eggshell, you see, the strength of it is what is called double curvature, and it will never fail.
Phil Vittori was at Cal Earth when the city of Hesperia tested the domes with an earthquake simulator. The homes didn't budge or crack. In fact, the earthquake simulator began to bend and buckle.
We had to call the test at that point. We were well past any design load characteristics. We were over double the amount that would be required by code.
Kalili got the seal of approval from the UN and FEMA, but the designs are pretty radical, so agencies have been slow to adopt them wholesale. Kalili realized that if he wanted to spark a worldwide movement, he needed to make them popular in America.
This is so great. Oh, my goodness.
Maureen lives in San Bernardino, the first county in the nation to officially approve the Super Adobe Homes. She's planning to put one up.
You should be able to just go to your local zoning board and say, look at this. The R insulation factor is better than anything else. Can build itself. It's very easy on the eye. You know, everyone should be living like this.
But local building and planning departments have been the biggest hurdle. Their codes only cover traditional housing.
I had to bring in the text of analyzing a dome for the building department and then run the numbers for them and then teach them how to read the text. Otherwise, they had no idea how to evaluate the design.
A lot of people told me they were frustrated with the pace of progress, but Kalili was always patient. He knew he had inspired a movement. And now that he's gone, his friends and students are ready to take over the CalEarth Institute. And visitors to CalEarth will keep dreaming of living in a house that beats an earthquake, stays cool without air conditioning, doesn't harm a single tree, and costs less than a used car.
As my son was suggesting, he says one of the ways that we can get it into American market is to do some sitcoms in these structures. And he may be right, you know. You know, the sitcom, everybody feels comfortable and funny and experience all of these, and then they'll want it.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Malinsky.
You can see the CalEarth house and find out how to build your own at studio360.org. Coming up, Matthew O'Coin has been composing music since he was 5 years old, but something about the process still eludes him.
I wrestle with a particular piece for 5 weeks, and then I finish it, and then the next day, a piece like drops as if from a helicopter into my head almost fully formed. And that's never the piece that I was expecting to write.
Matthew O'Coin performs live. That's next up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'd like to thank my mommy.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360.
Welcome to the Golden Globe Awards.
It is awards season, and as far as awards shows go, the best bet for most entertaining are the Golden Globes.
Ah, all right, all right, all right.
You get the best in movies and the best in TV. You get the glamour, the speeches, and it's all fast and loose and schwasted.
I had a few vodkas under my belt, and here we are.
And the winner...
Here at Studio 360, we like to put on our own Golden Globes party. And for the broadcast on Sunday the 11th, we have created a bingo card. Instead of squares for B9 or N27, our squares say things like refuses to wrap it up and swears on live TV and mentions North Korea.
Ooh, that's a bingo.
You can download your Studio 360 bingo card from our website, or you can play right on your tablet or phone or computer. We've got everything you need for Golden Globes bingo at studio360.org.
Is that the way you say it? That's a bingo?
You just say bingo.
Matthew O'Coin has accomplished more than some musicians do in a lifetime, and he's 24 years old. He has conducted the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the Rome Opera Orchestra, and the LA Philharmonic. He is the youngest assistant conductor ever at the Metropolitan Opera. And he is now working on operas commissioned by the Lyric Opera of Chicago and the American Repertory Theater. Oh yeah, and 3 years ago, he graduated summa cum laude from Harvard, where he studied with the poet Jory Graham. Right now, Matt Alcoin is working on a song cycle based on the poems of James Merrill. And he's agreed to let us listen in to some of that work in progress today. Matthew Alcoin, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here.
So given that summary of your prodigal young life so far, you are naturally compared all the time to Mozart and Leonard Bernstein. I might personally throw in Edgar Varèse as well, but it's inevitable that you get those comparisons. But how do you feel at age 24 about the extremism of them?
Look, I don't want to be the next anybody. I want to be me.
Yeah. You are now working on a song cycle based on the poetry of the late James Merrill. What attracted you?
You know, Merrill gets compared to Mozart sometimes. But the thing that they have in common that's really specific and that drew me to Merrill is that the sweetest parts are also the parts that hurt the most. And the reasons for it are musical. Merrill loves musical effects like puns. He'll make you hear alternate meanings of a word when he's using a word a particular way, and it's like it's resonance. And I find it so rich to set to music.
So would you mind reading one of James Merrill's poems for us?
Sure. This is a poem called A Downward Look. Seen from above, the sky is deep. Clouds float down there, foam on a long, luxurious bath. Their shadows, over limbs submerged in air, over protuberances, faults, a delta thicket, glide. On high, the love that drew the bath and scattered it with salts still radiates new projects, old as day, and hardly registers the tug when, far beneath, a wrinkled baby hand happens upon the plug.
That is lovely. And also, sometimes Merrill's poetry can be full of classical and exotic allusions and obscurities. That one, not at all.
No, I think it's a case in which Merrill's really a prophet of global warming. You know, it's this vision of being in an airplane and seeing the sky reflected in the water. It's a very modern, sort of a godlike perspective. And then at the end, the wrinkled baby hand is the power of humanity happening right upon the plug of the bathtub that is the ocean. And, you know, maybe it's like popping the ozone layer and letting the bath out.
Or the final scene of 2001, A Space Odyssey. So you say, okay, I love this poem. I want to make a song out of this. What do you do first?
I feel out the way the poem moves. This poem is spoken from a unique perspective. If you're in an airplane, you're kind of the still center of this seascape and skyscape of motion. It's a false sense of stability. You know, this song begins with this kind of crashing counterpoint on a single chord that doesn't change for quite some time. It's the sky flowing by, the sea flowing by. If I slow the motion of the beginning of the song down, it's actually really simple two-part counterpoint. That is, two lines that kind of mirror each other the way the sky and the sea mirror each other in the poem. It's kind of motion within a single harmonic region, so that when it hits heavy weather, it feels all the more seismic because we've been in this very sort of, like I said, a false sense of stability, of being outside the whirlwind.
And then at what point do you start figuring out how particular musical moments correspond to particular words?
In this case, I think the words should float above this texture.
Uh-huh.
So that when it begins, seen from above, the sky is deep. Seen from above, the sky is deep.
and so forth. The voice is the sort of still center around which this landscape is moving. So that's the perspective that felt right for this song.
Yeah. So as you're musically aiming toward this final image of this wrinkled baby's hand pulling the plug, do you have that figured out before you have the rest figured out?
Yeah, the meat of the song is what develops last for me. Uh-huh. You find the world that the song lives in, and you find the maximum sort of pressure point, that kind of dynamism, and then you figure out how you get there. It's like solving a puzzle.
And so how long does it take to get what you've played, this basic musical notion? Is that then days, weeks, before you feel like, yeah, I'm pretty much done with this?
Totally varies. One thing happens to me all the time, which is that I wrestle with a particular piece for 5 weeks, and then I finish it, and then the next day a piece like drops as if from a helicopter into my head almost fully formed. And that's never the piece that I was expecting to write. So it's very unpredictable.
And then in those instances, you throw out what you've done and say, oh, that's it.
Yeah, I tend to trust the unexpected arrivals.
Yeah. And you started composing many years ago, right? You were a child, a little child.
Yeah, I was six or so. I mean, I just wanted to make stuff up. The piano was the instrument I chose, but that was just the way to make stuff up.
And what was the first thing you made up?
It was this strange thing made of fifths, you know, that interval. It was very ugly. I think it was because I'd only played so-called pretty music before then, and I wanted to make the ugliest thing I could.
So really, you were already, it's ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny. You were already at five, rejecting the beautiful canon?
Well, loving it, but knowing I needed to do something a little different.
Huh.
I think the first thing I learned to play, apart from Ode to Joy, was the Gilligan's Island theme. I don't know how beautiful that, you know, like. Oh, wait, those are fifths. So that's where I got it, clearly. Huh.
So it's all that three-hour tour is where it all came from. And then you composed an opera at 10 or 11 about one of my children's favorite books of all time, the Redwall books.
Mm-hmm.
So had you heard enough opera at 10 or 11 to say, okay, I get this?
I loved to make stuff up at the piano. Yeah. I loved to read. It seemed like a natural way to bring them together.
Yeah.
I hope that piece never sees the light of day.
Really? I could see it having a, you know, lucrative touring life.
Well, let's talk afterwards, actually. That's an idea.
I mean, I remember by 10 or 11, I was writing things. I thought, okay, this is reasonable. Maybe I could keep doing this. Is that what you felt at 11?
Yeah. And then I had a kind of crisis about it when I was 12 or 13, where I was playing more out at contemporary music festivals. And I just didn't like the atmosphere in which this music was being born, especially when I could compare it with playing in a rock band with my friends. I just barely started to do.
Did your time in a rock band and doing jazz and stuff have any permanent effects on how you compose music?
Yes. I think everyone should learn jazz at some point. It's so liberating.
Basically the improvisational aspect of it?
Yeah, and the independence that it teaches you. I still think that classical musicians often are not taught rhythm in a really rigorous way.
Huh.
Whereas with a jazz musician, you're always learning about how to feel beats that you're not playing and being able to sort of, you know, go. Or whatever. You have to feel all the silences inside of yourself with total conviction if you're going to stand up there and take a solo. And I think for me, an important next step in how music's taught in this country is to bring that to the conservatories.
How do you get your contemporaries, my contemporaries, but people, and especially young people, to care about classical music?
You drag them into the room and you play it for them at close range. You know, I have this concert series at a museum near Boston where we've done stuff like the Berg Violin Concerto, which is a really thorny piece, with the orchestra sitting among the audience. It's like a pizza with alternate slices of orchestra and audience, and the violin soloist in the center, like theater in the round. And we actually had people coming up to us afterwards and saying that was like a rock concert. It was sort of immersive and overwhelming. And for me, music, including classical music, is cathartic and overwhelming, and I want people to feel it that way.
Matt O'Coyne, it has been fascinating talking with you and getting a bit of a glimpse of your creative process. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. It's been a pleasure.
And would you be willing to play us out with A Downward Look?
Sounds good.
The composer Matthew O'Coyne. We'll check in with him later this year to see how the new song cycle is coming along. In the meantime, you can hear him playing a song based on a different poem at studio360.org. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, the director Kevin Smith wants to see your 30-second romantic comedy. The deadline's coming up soon, February 1st, so enter early and often at studio360.org/romcom. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frassica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Scott Ross,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoke.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the actress Glenn Close has played a lot of very complicated women. Alex in Fatal Attraction, Patty Hughes in Damages, Cruella de Vil.
If you play a strong woman, a lot of people say that you're evil. Put a woman in a position of power and people get very uncomfortable.
Glenn Close, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.